Good morning. My name is Charlie, and I'm an alcoholic. And before I embark on this odyssey of woe, I want to thank my friend Joe for inviting me to be here. It's really an honor to be asked. It's a pain in the butt to do it, but if you know Joe, he'll get you to do it. And Alcoholics Anonymous, for those of you who are new, is a terribly, terribly inconvenient thing, I got to tell you. God knows we sympathize with your lack of sleep and everything, but you'll find that the more willing you are to operate within your inconvenience, the better you feel. So it's a good deal everywhere around. This is a great conference here. I didn't realize I knew so many people who were in Brownwood, Texas. I've never been to Brownwood, Texas before. It's not one of the whistle stops for American Airlines, I don't think. This is good. It's only about 8 o'clock in the morning in Los Angeles, so I'm giddy as hell. I love Sheila. I love what she had to say. I'm looking forward to hearing Leo and Larry tomorrow. I want to thank everybody for... There was a whole crowd of them that came and picked me up at the airport. Larry and Sam and Gracie and Jimmy, who... The reason the flowers haven't opened yet is because they're still not sure they're out of Jimmy's van yet. He's not driving anymore. You can open now. Jimmy got that thing going on the highway. I thought wings were going to come out of the side. He's just going to lift that off. That's the only Airstream I've seen with a flight attendant. Somebody tried to steal it the other night at that Brown Towners meeting. Some crazy guy jumped in and tried to steal Jimmy's van. And all I can say is he's lucky Jimmy's sober. He doesn't know how lucky he is. He's been touched by God. He ain't even sober yet, this other guy. He'll have something to say. But we just had a lot of fun. Now the sorry part. I got a comment on the people who are at the commitments here in the Jim Shaw jumpsuits. Nice touch. I look down. He's still here. Jim used to have the damnest collection of jumpsuits. You can see that guy from an airplane. Lime green. It was unbelievable. We had a lot of fun with Jim and his jumpsuits. And there are a lot of people here that people mentioned over the weekend. Calvin and Jim and I've talked with Joe. We're talking about Bob White, who I never got to meet, but have heard his tape and have enjoyed the message. The message carries on, and it's good to see that there's such a continuum of sobriety at a conference like this. It's amazing. I go to a lot of conferences, and I see that there are people there, and there are people there who've been there for years, but there doesn't seem to be that interconnection that in most of them that I see here. And this is great fun to see. It's fun to watch. I've never experienced it before, and God forgive me, don't tell anybody outside of here that I said this, but it's actually fun to watch other people having fun. Usually I just hated to watch other people have fun. Public displays of affection were offensive. All that hugging and touching and just I don't think so. I probably should just start telling my story, right? We want to get out of here in time for Gracie to have more than about 12 minutes. I had a hideous childhood. Both my parents adored me, and it was really difficult because, as far as I'm concerned, love is harder to take than hatred. I would much rather be hated than love, because at least with hatred you can get some torque going. People don't like you can go back against it, but when people say they love you, you get the sense, at least I do, that there's some kind of transaction going on that I don't know what my part is in it, but I better say something quick. And it's usually I love you too, and then walk away grumbling I've been conned again, I've been pushed in the corner again. I'm an only child. My father was a carpenter. My mother was, I like to say, was a humble virgin woman. And practice. Which, for your information, there is a P in that word. Not two B's. But my parents didn't have many resources. My mother had four full-term pregnancies, and all three of the other babies died at birth. And when I was born, I would cough, and that house would become sterilized. My mother would be trotting around washing. We had non-allergenic Christmas trees for as long as I can remember. I remember one time I was at someone's house at Christmas wondering, what's that smell? And someone said, it's pine. I thought, I've never smelled that before. We never had a real tree, always because I was sick. And I was sick a lot as a child, and would sit at home, and I would watch television, and I would watch these great old movies with William Powell and Errol Flynn and David Niven and all these guys who had such style and such, panache. And I thought, who do I want to be like? Errol Flynn or my dad? Let's see. No, it's a difficult one. And they always had something in common. That was that everybody was always mixing up a shaker of drinks in those movies. And I thought that was cool because, William Powell and Myrna Loy would come home and find a dead body on the living room floor. They wouldn't call the police. They'd go make martinis. So, this, to me, is what a gentleman does, Especially if you're alone in a room with a dead guy and Myrna Loy, but that's another story. But I, fantasy number 389. I thought this is what men were supposed to be like, not like my father, who was... My dad was a DI in the Marine Corps for 8 years, and he worked in the garage all the time. He was sawing wood. He always had sawdust on his glasses and wore those crepe-soled shoes. And when he'd go to work in the morning, he'd take a lunch pail instead of a briefcase. And everybody else's dad seemed to have briefcases, and they all seemed to work on Wall Street, even though I knew that Wall Street isn't in Anaheim, California. But they all seemed to trot out looking snappy and ready to go. And my father kind of walked out and went to his job, and I was embarrassed by everything. There's never enough for me in my life. I always felt like there was something missing, always. And when I was in school, my parents were always brought in before some magistrate, whether it was a teacher or a principal or a counselor or a priest, and they were always informed that Charles has potential. I just don't know why he doesn't do anything about it. And my response was always the same. Great. I've got potential. I know I've got potential. I've always known that. My parents now know I've got potential, thanks to you. And I've got potential. It's like all God's children know Charlie's got potential, so why don't we just leave it alone? Well, I'll use my potential when I'm good and ready to, but I'm just not ready to now, Skippy. Maybe you can take your concerns about my potential and work them on some other sap. I'll use my potential when I'm ready to use it. And when I do, I hope you're wearing sunglasses because I'm going to light you up. But until then, just let me give you a little suggestion and suggest that you go wipe your idiotic concern on somebody else because I'm not buying. And if you were such hot stuff anyway, you wouldn't be a high school counselor, now would you? I felt that. It never came out in so many words. I think I said I'll try harder. But I've always remembered going around with a sense of absolute, unexplainable anger at everything. Just anger at everything that I didn't have, at everything that everybody else seemed to have. And it was impossible for me to see the goodness in other people. I could not. It just irritated me. I would watch, I hated my own generation. I hated my parents' generation, which put me in a very difficult position. Lonely, actually. And I was no shining star at school. I graduated when I was 17. I went right into the music business. I was a clerk in a record store. And it was there that some of the hoodlums of my school, who are by today's standards like the Boy Scouts, but these were some sort of the tough guys at school, and they came and started hanging out in the record store, and they invited me to a party one time, and I went to this party, and which was an unusual circumstance because there were other people at the party, and I I have one thing that I remember very well, and that is I have an uncontrolled anger and hatred of the human race. I despise people, but on the other hand, I demand their love and approval at the same time, which again, torques the city. And I don't know if anybody else experiences that, but it caused a lot of pain. But I went to this party anyway, just because I had my dance card what was open that night, and I went and somebody gave me a can of malt liquor. I didn't know what to do. I was standing there at the party. I was not a drinker. My parents weren't drinkers. I thought the drinkers at my school were weak-willed trash bags. They weren't going to amount to anything. And I was right. But I got this can of malt liquor, and I started drinking. And by about halfway through this 16-ounce can of liquor, I started to feel something completely different. And the only reason I tell anything about the time before I started drinking is that I always have to remember exactly what alcohol relieves me of before I can ever appreciate what sobriety is all about. Because alcohol, at that moment that I had that first can of booze, made me feel different. It made me feel complete. It made me feel as if that missing piece that I've been looking for, I didn't know I was looking for it. And for those of you who are new, trust me, I knew none of what I'm telling you this morning at the time that it was happening. It's only been, I forgot to mention, I'm sober since the 11th of June of 1981, and it's only been since then, and lots of AA meetings, and doing the steps, so I have any inkling as to what was going on at the time. But it wasn't coming to me at the moment that it was happening. But I started to feel happy. I started to feel connected to the people in the room. I didn't have that sense of separateness from everybody. I felt like I was at one with everybody in the room. And I felt joy, where I'd never experienced joy. It was coming from the inside out, and it was radiating through me. And I felt so damn happy, I just wanted to run out and start, barking at cars. I was excited to feel that way. And I felt a sense of hope that was uncharacteristic of me. And I wanted to drink some more. And I drank till the end of that night. I drank more and more, and I wound up in a blackout running alongside of my best friend's car, throwing up in the wind and just laughing my butt off because I had been there. And if you are like I am and you're an alcoholic like I am, you never drank to get drunk. You never drank to get stupid. You never drank to embarrass your family. You never drank to lose your job. You drank like I did, I believe, to get there. That place where I go when I drink. It's that safe place where everything is going to be okay and it's about to get better. And we may have had we may have all different stories and all different circumstances in our lives, but I guarantee you that most alcoholics that I've met drink to get, we will drink under the worst circumstances with the memory that at some point we're going to get there just for a little while. That place where everything's going to be okay and I can kind of get some control over my life. Because what alcohol did for me was it gave me a sense of control. I was married when I was 25, and my wife was not an alcoholic, and I kind of tore that one into the ground. But she would drink. She tried to drink with me, and she would drink, and she'd say, "I got to stop. I'm starting to lose control." And I thought, "You're just not committed." I don't understand that, because when you drink, I thought everybody felt the same way I did. When I drink, I start to feel a sense of control for the very first time. I'm out of control sober. I hate things sober. I'm brittle sober. I burn up sober. I grind sober. I'm like, I'm like Captain Kangaroo with a loaded weapon sober. I'm trying to be nice to everybody, but shape up or somebody else. I'm afraid I'm going to have to kneecap Mr. Green Jeans. So I started my drinking career at that party, and I drank anytime. I was 18 years old at the time, and I was, I had some goals. I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be useful and do something. And I found something equally fascinating about alcohol from the fact that it gets you there, and that is that alcohol gave me the satisfaction of a job well done without ever having to do anything. I have a couple of drinks, It's done, as far as I'm concerned. And it's not exactly done. I just have to do the paperwork. But as far as all the other stuff, I'm writing the novel as I'm sitting here. I'm down at the Humdinger in Anaheim, California, having some beers with all the other intellectuals in there and the brain surgeons and astronauts waiting for a flight. We're all in there fixing things, you know. I'm coming up with ideas. You know, that was a hotbed of ideas, the Humdinger. And I started to drink, and my drunkalog is really boring. I have the most boring drunkalog in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a sick, twisted drunk at a minor key, and I've heard your story, so I know how wimpy I am. I mean, I've come to meetings, I've heard people talk about stuff that just amazed me. When I was newly sober, I was just sitting there going, I only came to the meetings to hear the drunkalogs, you know, guys talking about. I remember hearing a priest one time saying he came out of a blackout in a hot tub with a couple of hookers. And I thought, go, Father. I heard people talk about fireballing cars. You know, I picked up 16 parked cars when I was drunk one New Year's Eve. I thought, you know, I used to just drag mine across a wall as I'm backing up, you know, or bump it into a post, or rear end somebody at about 6 miles an hour. Just enough to have somebody pull me out of my car and drive off. You all right? Yeah, I'm going to be in a second. I have wedged my car between newsstands and on the sidewalk in front of a fast food restaurant while people are inside looking out the window. And I'm just coming out of the blackout, you know, and there I am stuck. And I didn't put the car here. Somebody did. I'm just trying to get it out. I don't know how I got here. Don't look at me like that, you moron. If you had any class at all, you come out here and help me out. But you just sit there with your little hamburger looking out the window. It's so annoying. But never a fireball, nary a spray. I rolled a car once, but it didn't burn. So I've never come out of a blackout yelling, cover me, I'm going in. It just gets more and more depressing the more I think about it. I get to AA and hear what I miss. I never took a morning drink except on weekends. I get into AA and I hear that's the way you stop feeling bad in the morning. I thought, I would sit there for hours just clawing my nails across the Formica counter going, oh God, somebody kill me. I get into AA and people say, yeah, you take a morning drink, it goes away. Thank God I'll just take your word for it. I'm a blackout drinker. I don't have many great blackout stories. I came out of blackouts at places like the dry cleaners. With a guy leaned over the counter going, boxed or hangers. Oh, I'm sorry. Can you run that past me? Can I just stop you? I always just sort of materialized somewhere. For a while, it was great. It was close to metaphysical transportation as I could get. It was like being beamed someplace. I'd be drinking at a party in Long Beach, and I'd blink twice, and I'd be standing in my apartment in Santa Monica with my car keys in my hand going, the travel time I'm going to save. just get good and drunk just one more, and poof, I'm gone, all of a sudden I'm in my living room. But unfortunately, you can't plan where you're coming out of these things, and I've come out of blackouts trying to get on the freeway the wrong direction. And not feeling horrified or embarrassed, just feeling angry that they don't put better signs up to tell you I was getting on the off-ramp. And I thank God that there were people coming off the off-ramp who were sitting at the light bumping my bumper to get me to back off and blinking their brights at me, because I could easily have done that. And I don't believe God was with me that night. I hear people say, well, you know, God was riding with you that night. God's no fool. I was not blessed that night. I was not gifted by God's grace. What happened was, I was lucky. I was just plug lucky. A lot of us who are alcoholics just like I am, who are good people, and you look around an AA meeting and you see people and they talk about the horrible things they've done, and you sometimes question, can this person be that bad, because they're such good people, you know? They're selfless, they're useful, they're full of joy. It's hard to imagine sometimes that people had pasts that caused them to do things that are shameful, and that they've had to take dramatic steps to change in their lives. But I think that there are people just like me and just like you who are out in Los Angeles right now who are getting on the freeway in the wrong direction and killing people. And they're no worse than I am, but they just weren't lucky like I was. I was lucky. I have a friend named Paula in Southern California who was not lucky, and she killed a guy, hit him head on in her car, and killed a man, and she spent the rest of her life and the rest of her sobriety trying to make some sense and some use out of that man's life. And I don't believe that God was with me and not with Paula. You know, I have to believe that God is with everybody, but that some of us are lucky and some of us aren't. And I missed the bullet. You know, I just happened to miss the bullet. It doesn't matter. It's not, there's no sense of sanctity, and I'm not one of the chosen ones, as I hear sometimes in meetings people saying, I was chosen to stay sober. No way. No way. I was lucky to stay sober. I was lucky to find people who brought me into AA and were able to help me, and was lucky enough that my feelings I was beaten down enough to be willing to listen to what people said. And like I said, I was married. To back up a little bit, when I was 23, my father died of cancer. He had about a 4-month or 3-month bout with lung cancer. And I couldn't get out of Santa Monica to go down and visit him. And it was about 40 miles away. And by that time, I'd gotten into publishing. You know, I was in a receiving clerk at a bookstore. And I was my mother would call me and say, are you coming down to visit your dad this weekend? And I would say, you know, I got so much stuff to do. I just started this new job. And I go down to this place called the Ore House in Santa Monica and just sit there and drink and not go down and see him. You know, I always kept my father at arm's length, because I never felt connected to my parents. You know, I always felt like a stranger in the house. I always felt like somebody who didn't really belong in this family, like I'd been placed there and I don't know who they are and they don't know me and I don't want to talk about it. You know, and my parents are of a generation that you just don't go out and air your linen. You don't talk about your feelings, and which some days I just yearn for now. But since most people never met a feeling they didn't want to talk about. But my parents were lovely, loving people. My dad was dying, and I couldn't get down there to see him until about the last week before he died. And then I didn't drink that whole week. I didn't drink, and I couldn't eat, and I lost about 17 pounds in a week. I just dropped it. And then at his wake, one of his best friends came up and handed me a water glass full of vodka and said, you know, here you go. And I started off drinking again, and that was, you know, I just started moving into hard liquor. And I drank because I love the effect that alcohol has on a guy like me. It gives me hope. I can never forget that. The thing that's troublesome about alcohol is that the very thing that causes me later on the most trouble physically, emotionally, spiritually, and within relationships with other people is the only thing that makes life worth living for me. And that kind of contradiction, that kind of dilemma that alcoholics face, and Gene Duffy used to talk about this. Gene Duffy was a sober AA member who died about 10 years ago. He had a ranch in Northern California, and a lot of people got sober at Gene's ranch. And Gene said that there's a point where an alcoholic sits at a bar and looks at a glass of whiskey and says, if I drink this, it'll kill me, but if I don't drink this, I'm going to die. What do I do now? You know, and I reached that point on the 11th of June of 1981. I had burned up my marriage. My wife, unfortunately, I loved her as much as I was capable of loving anybody, but I had no concept about love. I mean, I've got no trouble with relationships until another person's involved. Then I fold. I mean, I was kind of, well, cash me out. And I thought being married would somehow give me that elusive missing piece that would make me feel better. And I tried with a lot of different stuff. You know, I have my drug story. The only problem I have with drugs is that drugs got me loaded, you know, and got me high. I don't want to be loaded. I want to be there. You know, I don't want to be sitting around smoking pot till 3 in the morning and listening to one chorus of a Steely Dan song for about 4 hours and then wind up in the kitchen at dawn eating ketchup packets. That's kind of sad. That may give some of you a big rise, but that'd be a thing for me. I took amphetamines for a while. There's nothing quite like having the sensation of your eyes trying to beat you into the next room, you know? Come on, Paul, let's go! Your whole life is spent going, no one, no one, no one, no one! Or you take downers, you know, Valium, and just sit around the house going, I've been going to the hospital for a while because I was peeing blood, and I was after my wife and I had separated, I was having some difficulties, some physical difficulties, probably just emerging childhood illnesses like urine in the bloodstream. But I call my remaining friends because I didn't have friends who abandoned me. You know, I just disengaged my friendships. I just stopped calling people. I just stopped seeing people. I just stopped being involved and kind of disengaged everybody. So that I was under the illusion that I had no friends. What had happened was I was a friend to no one. I couldn't be a friend to anybody because I had to protect what I was doing, and I had to protect that little fantasy that someday I'm going to get off this receiving dock and I'm going to wear a shirt that doesn't have my name on a patch in it on it, and I'm going to go out and I'm going to do something and write something good. But I can't do that today, so I'm going to have a drink, and I'll do it later. But and then the cycle would start again. And I started going to therapy, which I was certainly wasn't going very well. And she was a wonderful therapist, and this woman was professional, and she was kind, and she did everything in my interest. She did exactly what a therapist is supposed to do. But you can't. Her main direction was, I want you to be honest with me. God, you know, I came in one time smelling of alcohol, and she said, if you ever come into my office smelling like that again, I'm not going to treat you anymore. So I drank after the meetings, you know, after the sessions, and but I would not, I religiously not drink, you know, before. And I would go in there, and she'd say, you have to be honest. And I couldn't be honest with her, and you make very slow progress when you're not honest with your therapist. I didn't want her to not like me. I couldn't tell her what I was doing. And she'd say, well, you have to be honest with your wife. You have to tell her what's going on. Oh, good, yeah, Leo. Good idea. Yeah, I'll tell her. I'll be honest. Okay. Yeah, I can wait. I can't wait till that day when she walks in the door. Honey, I'm home. How was your day? Oh, it was great. Got up about an hour after you did, hungover. Went down to the liquor store, got a couple of bottles of champagne because I'm sure David Niven drinks that in the morning. And it was, what, 99 cents a bottle? Why not? But I drank that. I got kind of bored, and I decided not to go to work today. And I instead went down to the Pussycat Theater in Torrance, and I caught the afternoon showing of Donkey Lunch. And then I went back to sitting there for a couple of hours just doing a little research for my novel. I went out there, I did something really disgusting in the car on the way home. I got there, I went, stopped off at a liquor store and got a bottle of cheap bourbon. I came home, took a shower, started drinking. How was your day? You know? You can't be honest with anybody when you're drinking. You can't tell them the truth. Your coworkers? Be honest with your coworkers. How was your weekend? Great. Got off work Friday, drank a quart of gin. Went down and got thrown out of the Orr House because they didn't want me to come in. I went back, I smoked a big bunch of hashish with my neighbor. It didn't do much for me, but I was wound up standing on top of the roof yelling, "Wiggle," to the cars down below. Came to the next morning, got up, I went down and started drinking with my buddy John at the Humdinger down in Anaheim, and we drank there for about 14 hours. I came home, my mom was gone for the weekend, so I broke into her house, and woke up the next morning wearing one of her nightgowns. So I tried to clean everything up, you know, and get the smell of vomit out of the room, and mop up the floor because somebody had urinated, and damn cats were coming in through the dog door, and then I just went home and I bought a bottle of booze. I got some change out from between the seats of my car because by that time I was out of money. And I just sat here in the living room of my house and my apartment, and I looked out the window and I thought everybody else has somebody that they care about and some life that they're living. And my wife is left. And I'm just sitting here feeling like the loneliest human being in the world. And I wish I was dead. How was your weekend? You can't be honest about anything. I built such an architecture of lies that I could never figure out what was going on in my life. And so what happened was I went to a retreat with this therapist on the 11th of June of 19... Oh, it was the 12th of June. I had my last drink on the 11th of June. I wound up going to this retreat. I had what I believe to be God's intercession in my life. It sounds very dramatic, but it wasn't. It was a very quiet thing. I was up there. We had a guided meditation. If you've ever been to therapy, they have these things where they take you through a field, and everybody in the room's got their eyes closed. They're laying on the floor, and they're all meditating. There are about 10 of us in this room, and I was the only one who could feel the shag carpet skewering me in the back. You know, I'm kind of bouncing around a little bit on the floor because I hadn't had a drink in about 12 hours, And she was guiding us through all this stuff, and then she said, "Now I want you to go out on the grounds and spend the next 5 hours thinking about where you are in your life right now and where you're going to be in 5 years." I thought, I got a better idea. Why don't I just put my face right in front of the bumper of your car and you floor it? Because I haven't got a clue what's going to happen to me in 5 years. I went out and I was going to hang myself at this meditation retreat, which is certainly, you know, certainly grounds for a refund, I would say. I hope nobody's gone out and done that since I've been talking. Joe, get out your checkbook. But I sat out on those grounds and I just felt a thought came to me that I'm nothing, I'm never going to be anything, I'm 30 years old, and I'm useless, and I wish I was dead. I can't have a relationship, I can't keep my job going, I'm going to be fired from my job in a short time anyway, and I don't know what to do, and I just wish I was dead. And I got a feeling inside that was not a voice, but it felt like, it sounded like one, that said, "Yes, you're all the things that you're afraid of, but I still love you." I don't know where that came from. I felt completely and indescribably loved for about 10 seconds, completely filled up with love, and then it just disappeared. And I sat there and I cried for about 3 hours out on this the ground. I could not figure out what had happened to me. It was like somebody reached inside of me, changed, just turned my whatever that little navigational device is that's inside of you, just turned it a little bit and then walked away. And I couldn't deal. I felt like I was completely off kilter everywhere, and I sat there and cried. And I didn't realize until later, I wound up in sobriety becoming a teacher. I'm not a teacher anymore, but I was teaching for about 6 years. I taught writing, ironically enough, and I taught essay writing, and one of the essays that I would teach my students was how to write a how-to essay, how to do something, because it's important to know how to do that when you're in school. And So I would teach this essay, and I would use a model essay by a man who wrote about how to open an oyster. You know, just a simple how-to. And an experienced fisherman can take an oyster, and you can take an oyster and pull on it all you like, and that thing will not open. It's all muscle. You can tug and pull. You can epoxy it to two cars and have it try to pull it apart. It won't open. It will not open. But an experienced fisherman will pick it up, take his knife, and go, and open it right up. And you go, how'd you do that? And the essay talked about how you take the knife point, and you go along, and you find what's called the purchase point, because eventually that little guy's got a breeze, and he opens up a little air hole to let some air in, and that's the purchase point. And an experienced fisherman knows where that is, and he can just push the point of the knife in there and slide it wide open, and the oyster has no resistance to it because he's opened himself up a little bit, and he can't close up that fast. And a fisherman can just open him up, and you've got yourself an oyster. And I believe that's what God does with alcoholics. You know, we are so tight and pulled tight, but there's a point where we just have to drop it. I mean, we can't. And there's a point, I think, in every alcoholic's drinking where you have to make. It's a turning point. You know, it says that in the Big Book, and it's not as dramatic as you think. There's just a point where you go from being absolutely miserable to where you just don't know if you can be any more miserable, and you pause for a second to see how much farther you can go. And I believe that's when God just takes that, finds that purchase point, and just lets His presence be known. I'm here. He opened me wide up, and then closed me again, and said, "Now what are you going to do? Now you know I'm here. What are you going to do?" And I didn't know what to do. I went home from that retreat. I didn't buy any booze, though. I usually bought alcohol on the way home from anything. You have to make. It's a turning point. You know, it says that in the Big Book, and it's not as dramatic as you think. There's just $20 a month. I was about 4 months behind, 3 or 4 months, because that's a lot of scratch to get together at one time when you're drinking. And I bought popsicles, and I sat on the front porch of that house and ate popsicles, and would go in about every 25 minutes and barf up some melted rainbow thing, and I'd sit out there and just shook it out. And I didn't know that's what you should do. I mean, you know, sugar helped. I didn't have as grotesque detox as most people do, or I probably shouldn't even compare it, you know. I just had my detox, and I don't ever want to go through that again. It was a hot spell in the summer of 1981, and I shook it out for about 4 days. I would forget how to walk. I was at work one time, and there were some attractive women behind me, and I've been on hormone alert since I was about 9, so I know when there's a beautiful woman behind me, and I just forgot to walk. It's kind of got all wobbly legs, and I'm serious. I had to go sit down on a planter and sat there, you know, while they passed, and I thought, I just almost cried then. I thought, oh, God, damn it, what's the matter with me? I can't walk. I'm driving to work, and a seagull would fly by my car, and I'd have to pull over and cry. You know, which is not one of the excused absences when you're late for work. You know, I saw a seagull crying, why I had to cry. You know, that's not. My emotions were just fluttering on the surface, and I realized my sponsor later told me what you're getting when you're newly sober is raw information with nothing to buffer it against. Information that's not just raw, but it's information that I've never seen in a sober light before. Without something to protect me. And I didn't want to drink because I was sick. I was physically sick, and I had that experience, and I didn't know what happened to me. And I'd be in the car driving along, and I hear somebody going, Charlie, in the back seat. I look around, and there's nobody in the car. I saw these gnats around here. I got those kind of gnats that you get sometimes when you're detoxing, where you're talking to somebody, and they just appear in your peripheral vision, like that. And they're there. And you don't. Nobody will brush them. Like if I saw gnats on you, I'd have the courtesy to brush the gnats off. You know, that's just a human courtesy, or just pull them off, and you know. But it's protein. But I at least have the courtesy to dust them away. But you're talking to someone, and these gnats come up, and they're just a little cloud right here, and you have to turn to look at them. But they're gone. And they go behind you, I guess. You know, no matter where you turn, they're hovering. And then whoop, that back they come. And then you start looking at somebody again. So I learned I was having some trouble. I just would brush them away, you know. So I'm the only guy in the room standing going like this, you know, and I got a split. When I was about 6 months sober, I was at Clancy's yard, and they were playing softball. I was in the stands for some reason. And I was sitting next to this guy named Bill, and there was a guy named Kenny in our group who was a terrible, terrible drunk, and he would go out on these monuments. He'd go to take the garbage out and come back about 6 months later, you know. And Kenny was back from a drunk. He was about a day sober, and it was August of that year of 81. And Kenny's out there, and he's standing on the plate, and he's playing softball, because nothing is more fun than to watch a guy 24 hours sober try to hit a ball on a hot day. So they put Kenny out there, and Kenny's standing at the plate, and he's got the shakes, and he's standing there, and the pitcher throws the ball right into the strike zone. Still out, but Kenny won't swing, because this big swarm of gnats, like these gnats around him, this huge swarm of gnats was swirling around home plate. You know how they find a spot, and they just stay there, and they were swarming around Kenny. And Ken's standing there, and he's sweating, and he's looking, and then wham, the ball comes by again, strike two, and they're going, swing at him, Ken, that's the best I can give you. And he's looking, and they throw another one, and he wouldn't swing at it, you know. And finally, the guy next to me in the stand says, "We see him too, Ken," and he went. I will never forget that as long as I live. You can go to the finest alcoholism experts in the world, but unless they're alcoholics, they don't see the gnats. And they don't know that you think you see the gnats, even if they're really there, you know. So I had the gnats, and I got brought to my first AA meeting by a woman named Debbie, who was my soon-to-be ex-wife's sister-in-law. And Debbie had just gotten out of a detox, and she had 22 days of sobriety, and she 12-stepped me. And she knew that I was trying to stop drinking, and she asked me to take her to a meeting because she didn't have a car. And so I drove her to this meeting, and I didn't want to go in. I was so, oh, God, I can't believe, I don't want to go in. I think I was about 5 days sober at the time, and I just did not want to go into this meeting. And we pull up, and I said, I'll just go park, and I'll meet you out here when it's over. And she said, "No, why don't you come on in? I want you to meet my friend." And then she said, "It's a lot easier this way, I'll guarantee you." And I said, okay. So I pull the car over and park and go inside and get to meet all of her friends from the detox. Now, my first reaction to AA was not, you know, "I'm home." My first reaction to AA was, "Loserama." I see some people who are just cool and groovy on one side of the room, very cool, drinking coffee, and then you got the highly agitated ones like Warren running up, and you know, they got a phone number and something like a cookie and a cup of coffee, and you're over, they just are on you. And I just stood in the back of the room, and I've got my Deerstalker hat, I've got hair down on my shoulders and a nice mustache, and looking very John Lennon-ish. I had sunglasses on and a tweed jacket and a wool sweater vest and a shirt buttoned to the neck and a pair of dirty jeans and a pair of boots on. And it was about 105 that day. And I'm walking on my heels in the back of the room, and I'm going like this. And everybody's running up going, "Are you new?" And I would say, "I'm not new. You know, I don't plan to stick around and be old. I'm not an alcoholic. I just have bouts of enthusiasm with my drinking followed by weeks of remorse, but I'm not an alcoholic. I just want to find out how to drink." You know, I thought that's what AA was all about. They would teach you how many pieces of toast to eat, how many hours you go out, and how to cure a hangover. And all. I thought it was a practical place where alcoholics learned how to drink. I seriously believe that that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. And I get in there, and they're talking about not drinking. And that shocked me. I thought, well, that's an option, I'm sure. I'm sure that's one of the choices, that if you're really bad, you can't drink at all. But see, I just need to cool down a little bit, and then I can go back out. And as you said, they read it from the podium, that if you can make the right about face and drink like a gentleman, then our hats are off to you. And I thought, I'll be damned. You know, that's great. What a generous bunch of people, you know. That I'm not even like them, but they understand that there are people who don't have things as bad as they've got. And I still have that ember of potential burning in me. I'm just going to fan that little thing and get it going again and be out there doing the things I'm supposed to do. And thank you all. I hope you get well soon. Good night. And it didn't come out in so many words. I said, I'm with Debbie. But I got about 30 phone numbers that night, all from men, and I was stunned. I didn't know what to do. I went home from that meeting, and I didn't go to another meeting for a week, because I went back after a week, because I don't know if they do it here. Do they get chips here? Little mementos of 30 days and 60 days. Well, they were giving chips out at this meeting, and Debbie was going to go get her 30-day chip. And I thought, oh boy, a chip. Imagine that. So I went back to see Debbie get her chip. And I thought, this is the lamest thing I have ever seen. Anybody want to claim 30 days? I thought, come on. And she got her chip, and everybody was all excited. You know, they all went out. They dragged me out for coffee again. We all went out to this coffee shop, and I got stuck in the middle of the booth, and they were all yakking and snatching and scrabbling. And I'm sitting there thinking, I got to get out of here. I can't believe this. I'm here. How far down the chain? You know, what level of food chain is this? And I went back to my third AA meeting, which was the next week. I was going once a week, like church. And I hadn't been to church in probably 20 years, but I went the next week because the Tuesday after she got her 30-day chip, Debbie got drunk, and she didn't get back to AA for 8.5 years, and she got back in a lot worse state than she had been as I remembered her, and yet she apparently gave me something that I wasn't aware of at the time. What I realized later on was that when I was sitting in that meeting with people like you, it didn't matter how long you were sober or anything. I just felt completely safe. I couldn't identify it at the time. I felt completely safe in that meeting. I felt like everybody had my best interests at heart, even though I wasn't really an alcoholic, you know. And I came back again and again because I started to relate to what people were saying at the podium, and I just liked the people. And eventually, because I wasn't doing anything, they made me a greeter too, Sheila. They always pick the ones that are, I guess they get the most amusement out of the people who are the most resistant to change, and they make them greeters, you know. My MO was, welcome, run for your life, it's not going to work, you know. Hi, good to see you. This is awful, and I don't really belong here, but these people do, and I was feeling safe, but I wasn't getting any better. They kept talking about the 12 steps, these 12 steps, these 12 traditions, these giants who've walked here. Some kind of Jurassic Park of alcoholics. And all I could think of, I felt like I'd been to a good meeting if I didn't think, shut up, shut up, shut up, during some point during the talk. I'm sure you're relating right now. Please, God, make him stop. Three weeks later, I had a sponsor. I got a sponsor. Not because I wanted a sponsor, not because I thought a sponsor would help me find the spiritual path. I got a sponsor to shut you up because you kept asking if I had a sponsor. So I got a sponsor. Look, I've got a sponsor now. Are you happy? And so I got this sponsor, and he was great. He was a nice man up until I asked him to sponsor me. And then he sat me down at this coffee shop, and he said, I got to know something. Are you willing to do anything to stay sober? And I said, yes. And he said, good. I want you to shave that silly mustache off, maybe trim your hair, and I'll see you at the men's stag on Friday. Where does it say? And he said, it doesn't. I said, well, where is it in the big book? Now, I hadn't read the big book, mind you. I glanced at it. I'd studied literature in college, for crying out loud. I had explicated some of the greatest sonnets in the English language. I could tell you what Shakespeare was feeling in 1590. I couldn't tell you what I was feeling then, but I could tell you what he felt then. I explicated all this stuff. So the idea of reading a book with the jaywalker analogy in it was really not my idea of literature. You know? I went from "Shall I compare thee to a summer's day" to "G mine, grand the wind stop." I see some people out there going, "That's our big book he's talking about." I'm going to have to give him a Texas whooping. Relax. I noticed in the table of contents, though, there was no chapter of the barber. So I said, why do I have to, and he said, I said, where is it in AA? And he said, listen, it's not part of AA. It's not in AA. It has nothing to do with AA. And I'm not normally used to giving explanations after I've given a direction, but I'm feeling kind of generous tonight, sport. So let me give you one. You just said 30 seconds ago that you were willing to do anything to stay sober, right? I said, well, yeah. And he said, I just asked you to shave your mustache off, right? And I said, yeah. And he said, if you're not willing to shave your mustache off just because I asked you to, what makes me think you're going to be able to do the steps once I start giving you direction to do those? I just want to see if you're a loser or not. If you won't shave, that's fine. You don't have to shave. But I'm not going to sponsor you if you don't. So, as I said, you have a couple of days. I'll see you at the men's stag on Friday, and I hope that you're willing. But I'm not going to waste my time with you if you're not willing, because it's just a waste of my time. I'll find somebody who is willing. I thought, whoa. But, you know, that's a really arrogant attitude. You don't get babies like this knocking on your door every day. You don't get quality like this. I just be really careful who I have to shave. I'm 30 years old. I can make up my own mind. I make good decisions. I didn't come out that way. I said, okay. So, so I went home, and the day of the men's stag, I looked in the mirror, and it occurred to me in the same way that it occurred to me at that retreat that I went to, that if I fight one more thing, I'm not going to make it. And I don't believe this has anything to do with alcoholism or alcohol or my problems. My mustache has nothing to do with the trouble I have with the IRS. My mustache has nothing to do with the trouble I'm having with my ex-wife. My mustache has nothing to, it has nothing to do with anything. But I'm going to shave it off. And I shaved it off. I went to that meeting that night. And I walk in, and Bill's there, and he cuts his way through the crowd. He's a big guy, and he comes sidling up to me, and he puts his arm around my shoulder, and he says, here we go, sport. And, you know, he's been my sponsor through good times and bad since then. And Bill started to guide me through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in the way I see it happening here. And I was talking to Warren last night that we have been, and on Sheila, too, we've been touched by people who have had, and there are people in this room who have enormous amounts of sobriety, much longer in AA and Al-Anon than I do in AA, and who were here when it wasn't as easy, when there wasn't as much public acceptance of Alcoholics Anonymous, and who went ahead and did it anyway with enthusiasm and with anonymity. And I think a lot of the time we focus on the alcoholics part of it, and we forget the anonymous part. You know, it's Alcoholics Anonymous, and we do this silently. We do it, we don't go out and toot our own horn to people. And I think, quite frankly, this is my own opinion, that people are pretty tired of hearing about us out in the general public. They are sick to death of hearing about our triumph over adversity. They don't care. Why should they care? They've been triumphing over adversity all their lives. What do they care about our little setbacks? You know, it's a much greater credit to the program that people go out and do that stuff and they don't say anything about it. You know, we just do it and don't use the alcoholism. And I say, well, if you only knew what I'd gone through, you'd know why I'm such a failure now and why there's such a big chunk in my resume. I would panic if Bill said, okay, here's what I want you to do. And he got the same direction Sheila got. I want you to go to meetings early. I want you to shake people's hands. I want you to get 10 phone numbers a night from the men. I want you to go to coffee with people afterward. I want you to call me every morning. And I want you to be involved in AA and go to a book study. That's all. I don't want you studying the big book, though. You're not ready for that. Just go read the book, listen to other people talk about the book, and just get involved in AA. And I'll tell you what to do next when you're ready. And he was at every meeting I went to. My sponsor was always there, so I had to be at the meetings, you know. And I'd try to buffalo him sometimes, and I would not show up, and I'd say I had car trouble. But then the next night, I felt so bad, I'd have to go up to him and say, I lied. You know? And that was uncharacteristic for me to say that. I lied. And he said, and he laughed, and he said, I used to lie to Clancy, too. He said, I understand. Just call me if you don't want to go to the meeting, and we can talk. And then you'll still go, but... at least you'll feel like you have participated in the democratic process. So, Bill, I started doing all this stuff, and I'm doing it. I'm doing it for months. And I thought, I got involved in a relationship, and I fell in love with this woman, and she was 4 months sober, and I was 3 months sober at the time. And she changed before I did. You know, it's just a matter of months, and she left. She moved to New York, and... I was devastated. I almost drank over that because I had made her my higher power before I had been able to find a higher power for myself. I think that's very typical of alcoholics. We try to find somebody because we can't believe in something that's not tangible. So we try to find a person that we want to love. We want to give that love to them. We want to be something to them. And I did that, and it was a desperate thing. And it was the same thing on her part. And she's happily sober in New York now, and I still am in contact with her. And she's a lovely person and happily married, you know, and we have a good friendship. But So I wound up getting more focused on being involved in my group and showing up for my commitments. And I guess they call it service work in the Midwest and the South, but in our area we just call it commitments. And we take a commitment for the duration of the secretary's term. And we do it every week, and we treat it like a job. And if you can't do it, if you can't be there for some reason, like you're deaf, get somebody else to do it for you. Make sure that someone is there. And so that's what we did. And I didn't believe in this. I'm still resisting, but I'm taking the action even though I don't believe in it. You know, like that little girl in Miracle on 34th Street. I believe. It's stupid, but I believe. You know, it's just whoop-de-doo. I'm feeling really spiritual now. And I say to Bill, when am I going to start doing the steps? And he'd say, "What? Well, we'll talk at the meeting tonight." I'd go to the meeting. When are we going to start doing the steps? And this is about 7 months sober. When are we going to do the steps? I want to work the steps. I hear everybody talking about working the steps. I got to work the steps. I got to spot me. I'm going to do three. Okay. I get to get some cross training course to do the steps. As if you got to oil up to go out and do these things. And you need to do some AA stretching exercises before you start taking the second step. And I didn't understand what people were talking. I heard people talking about this because I was going to other meetings outside of my group because my sponsor said it's good to have a breadth of information about how other people do AA. And I get back to my group and I say, when am I going to do the steps? And one day I called him and I was panicked. And he came and picked me up at work and we drove off and I said, I don't know if I'm going to make it. Well, he said, what are you talking about? And I said, I'm not doing the steps. And he said, you're not doing the steps? What do you mean? And I said, I just don't feel like I'm doing the first three steps. And he said, are you calling me every day? I said, yeah. And he said, and you're going to your meetings every night because I see you there. Yeah. And you're doing your commitments or else somebody would tell me. Yeah. And Bill's a big, formidable guy. And he has a fuse about that long. And he said, well, you're getting phone numbers, and you're obviously going out for coffee, because we all go out for coffee after the meetings. Do you like going to the meetings every single night? I said, no. not really. Some nights I just don't want to go at all. And he said, well, what do you do then? I said, well, I go. He said, well, how do you feel after that? I said, well, I feel better. And he said, do you talk to other people? Do you talk to newer people? And I said, yeah. And he said, which part of the first three steps do you think you're not working? I said, I don't know. And he said, that is what AA is about. That is the steps. It's not talking about the steps. It's doing them on a really practical level. And I've realized over the years that Alcoholics Anonymous is not theory at all. And it says that in the big book, but, you know, some people who study the big book miss that. And while they're busy diagramming the sentence, you know, trying to figure out what Bill really meant by although. We've got meetings in my neck of the woods where just the weirdest shenanigans, you know, it's everybody hold hands and read the sentences backward and answer them as questions, and then, you know, maybe we'll start channeling Dr. Bob. I don't know, but throw down chicken bones and feathers and woogie 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 over the big book. I don't know. You want to go on a 12-step call? I don't know. I'm meditating. Hello! And I was lucky enough to... I was kissed by Chuck Chamberlain, which is where I think I caught alcoholism, quite frankly. Chuck spoke at every meeting I went to the first 3 months I was sober. And tonight it's Chuck C. And I went, oh, God! I've heard this guy. All he does is laugh at himself and hee-hee-hee-hee. And then yell... And then yell... And then he'd say something and he'd go, and nobody would laugh because they didn't know what he was laughing about. You know? You find that out later why he was laughing. Now we're starting to laugh, you know. Yeah, I get it. So I didn't get it then. I thought, oh, God. So I go up to thank him because people made me. And I go up to thank him and I'm ready to shake his hand and he goes, how long are you sober, boy? And I said, 22 days for me. Oh, God, I love you. Kiss me on the mouth. it was a grandpa kind of kiss, but it was just, you know, I thought, that's where I caught it. Right from Chuck Chamberlain. And I wound up being shipped up to Clancy's outfit and wound up in the Pacific group. And I didn't want to be there. Sat in the back row, scorned everything they did. Didn't want to do anything. Wound up getting caught up in the tide of things, and wound up doing it. And that's where I got Bill as a sponsor, and when I started being shown how to do the steps. And I did a 4-step and a 5th step. And I've done all the steps. And I'm not going to go through one by one and tell you how to do them. I will tell you though some of the results of what happened. My third year of sobriety, I wound up teaching a class at the college where I had been unloading books on the receiving dock of their bookstore for 10 years. And I wound up teaching an English class because I'd gone back to grad school at Bill's suggestion. That was the price I had to pay to complain. You know, if I didn't go to grad school, I couldn't complain about my job. So I went back to grad school just for the right to bitch. And then I started, I got a job the next year teaching high school. And I guess the pain was not bad enough teaching college kids. And I taught high school for 6 years, and I wound up just loving teaching at school. I had a hard time, believe me. It's difficult. It's a difficult job. People have to... You want to learn the meaning of the word unconditional love, talk to a high school teacher. You must love them unconditionally because they will never love you back because you want them to. And they will never be your friend. You just love them. And I learned that. You know, I'd go into class some days, I would not want to be there, and I'd have to go in and apply what people in my group... I have two nuns are sober in my... the same year I got sober, Sister Sheila and Sister Mary. And I asked Sister Mary, they're both in education, I said, what do I do with these kids? And she said, treat them like little newcomers. you just go in and treat them like newcomers. You let them know that you've got something they need and that you'll give it to them as long as they're willing to come the distance you want them to come. And I thought, that's great. So I did that. And these kids respected that. It's funny how you take the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and you apply them to people who are resistant to principle anyway because they have their own set of principles, and they respond to it fairly. And most of my kids were great. And I left that profession because I got a chance to write. And because I'd been teaching them writing for years, I learned how to write myself, because it was unfair of me to have them write and not do it myself, so I started writing myself. And my buddy Mark got me hooked up with this guy who wrote cartoons, and so, or he was an artist, and he directed cartoons, and I wound up writing cartoon scripts for him, and got into that, and got hired by the studio to write animation for 5 years from teaching. And after doing that for 5 years, I gave a presentation about what I was doing to the publishing division of that studio that I was working at. They have their own publishing division. I went in there to do a presentation because my boss couldn't do it. And I cursed it the whole time. I got better things to do. I don't want to go out and talk to publishing people. I hate doing this crap. God, man. I go in there. Hi, good morning. Everyone okay? Hi, good to see you. And I did this presentation. And halfway through the presentation, the vice president of the company walked me outside and said, "Would you like to be an editor? I hate to steal you away from another department, but we need an editor, and you seem to know what you're doing. What do you think? Why don't you think it over?" And I said, "Okay, I will. I'll do it." So I went from being a receiving clerk to being a senior editor at this publishing company for the last 4 years I've been there. And my wife is, you know, I don't attribute that to anything that I have done that's grand. I attribute that to having taken the actions that people in here are taking and people all over this country are taking in Alcoholics Anonymous to try to do the right thing and be useful, and then things change. I have no power over how they change. I taught a young girl named Sherry. I'll tell you, I have two stories I want to tell you, and I'll sit down. A young girl named Sherry who was deaf, but she could read lips. She had some hearing sensation and she could read lips. And Sherry was adorable. She was the most charming young woman. She sat in the front row of my class, and I taught her for 2 years. And each year was the same. It was an uphill drag with Sherry, and I could not. I would talk to people about teaching deaf students, and I would try to make her. The kids all loved her. I tried to make her feel comfortable. I would tease her. You know, you'd say the most important question that's going to be on the final exam is about John Keats. And I just had fun with her, you know, and she knew I cared about her. I really did care about her. The problem was that she didn't do any work. And I had meetings with her mother, and I would, you know, try to get her to do things, and she would do well on tests, but she would not do any homework or any writing, and she was bombing in my class. She was failing, and it took every ounce of jiggling the figures to try to figure out how to get Sherry to, because part of the responsibility, I believe, was my inadequacy in teaching a deaf student. And I could not hold her completely accountable for my inadequacy. So she passed, but just squeaked by, you know, and she was still charming and lovely and just a beautiful person. And I always felt a sense of, as far as teaching goes, this little sense of having failed at having gotten through to Sherry, you know, because of her disability. And I wound up talking to about 2 years ago. I was in line to get into my meeting, and I was talking to a young woman in my my home group, and I said, what are you doing these days? And she said, well, I'm teaching deaf students up at Cal State Northridge. And I said, really? And she does signing for our meeting sometimes. And I thought about Sherry then, and I went home, and this is no exaggeration, this is one of those weird stories. I went home the next day, and there was a letter in my mail, and it was from a teacher from the school that I had taught at, and he had forwarded this letter to me. He said, one of your former students contacted me and wanted me to get this to you. And so he had sent it to me. I open it up, and it's a graduation announcement from Sherry. And it had her picture in it, and it was from Cal State Northridge. And she wrote this beautiful letter, and she said, I wanted to write to you because I was in your class about 10 years ago, and I remember that I was not a very good student in your class. And I just wanted you to know that I've been trying to do my best in college, and I'm graduating in June, and I'm going to be an English teacher for deaf students. And I think that part of that was because I enjoyed your class so much, even though I didn't do anything. And I want you to remember that not a moment that you spent teaching me was wasted. I thought, wow, that's a really profound kind of a statement, because sometimes even in AA, when you work with new people and you find out they go out and drink again, and you work with other people and you think, I'm not doing it. It's not working, you know, because it's not meeting up to my expectations of the way things ought to be. And I get a letter from this woman whose life went on just fine without you can't screw somebody else up like that, because there is God in the mix. And God is a really delicate, subtle but powerful force in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you don't see him until you see him. You don't experience him until you experience him. And at 8 months sober, I was mopping the floor at Ohio Street, and I got the mop going. I'm thinking, oh boy, I'm getting spiritual tonight. It was our goal to get all the pews out and get the floor mopped and get the pews back into this place before the speaker left so we could thank him. And so, well, I'm mopping away, and as I'm mopping the floor, this is a month after I talked to Bill about not doing the steps and not, you know, this is not working. I'm looking at the faces of the people in line to thank the speaker, and I'm watching that. I looked across that line of people, and it was like it was in slow motion, and I knew every single one of their names, and I was fond of them. And I thought I wouldn't want to be anyplace else except standing here with this mop right now. Where did that come from? That's not the God I expected. See, he sneaks up and catches you when you don't expect him at all. And then before you realize what it is, it's gone. And you have to realize it in retrospect and know that that's what you're looking for and that's what you want. And the seeking. God is a big tease, you know. He makes us think that we've failed sometimes when he's got something else in store for us, you know. He'll work with whatever we dish out for him. I don't believe that he moves us around like chess pieces. I believe that if we ask him to help us, no matter what pickle we're in, he'll move us over to whatever we need as long as we're willing to follow what he's doing. Alcoholics Anonymous taught me that. They taught me that through the love of people in AA. And when I talk about love, I'm talking about the kind of love that is not the emotional kind. We will, I hate to say this, we will not love you until you can love yourself. We don't want you loving yourself. We will love you until you too can learn how to love. And I learned that before I ever got to AA, but I didn't know it until I got to AA. My own father. Now, I kept my father at arm's length my whole life, pretty much, just indifference, which is a cruel way to treat a person. And I taught a poem when I was teaching high school about a guy who was writing about his father, a very short poem, three stanzas, about how his father would get up in the morning and make the fire in the fireplace to warm the house up, to bring the family out, and he said we would stare at him with indifference. We'd treat him with without any thanks, and we'd just go about our day. And he said at the end of the poem, what did I know? What did I know about the lonely and austere offices of love? That it's just those ordinary little things that are acts of love. My own father, who I felt had been, you know, I've not had a real relationship with, I felt he judged me. Because I was not, you know, my athletic skills peaked at walking upright. And and my dad is a Marine and a drill instructor, gung-ho kind of guy. And from the time I was in the 7th grade till I was in about the 10th grade, my father would get up every morning, and he would, before anybody did, he was up at 4 in the morning, and he would make lunch for me. And my parents, like I said, have very few resources, so he would make lunch, and he'd put a sandwich, chips, a piece of fruit in the bag, and he would write my name on it, and he'd set it by the door, and he would iron a shirt for me to wear, and he would put it by the door, and he would leave and go to work. And I'd get up about an hour later, I'd go out, I'd put that shirt on, grab that lunch just as if it was supposed to be there, and walk out the door, and I'd get to the school property line, and I would drop it in the trash can before I walked on the campus. I'd throw that lunch in the trash, and felt that guilt, you know, and that sense of...